are friends with Fantasy Benefits.
Mike, how hard are you right now?
Oh, man, I've been hard since you said, hi, welcome to Friends with Fantasy Benefits podcast.
Well, we call it the Premature Edraftulation League.
That's a good name, though. I like that.
We are Friends with Fantasy Benefits.
I think I need to be announced as just Chuck because we have two actually, abnormal guests to the podcast, and they are both far more star-studded than me.
We are Friends with Fantasy Benefits.
Why don't you, again, remind people where you can reach on social media, and then, or where you can ignore them on social media.
You're going to have to change your kid's birthday, too. Find a different month. It's not baseball season.
We are Friends with Fantasy Benefits.
Welcome to the Friends of Fantasy Benefits Baseball Podcast. I'm Justin Mason, lead fantasy writer and analyst for friendsoffantasybenefits.com. Joining me on this episode are Chuck and Matt. Chuck, how you doing?
I'm good, but I think I need to be announced as just Chuck because we have two abnormal guests to the podcast, and they are both far more star-studded than me. And I'm excited because I don't get to talk to Matt all that often. We just banter back and forth on our different chat rooms, etc. So,
yeah, I apologize. It's a weird schedule this week. My daughter turned 7 on Monday, and I'm back in school now. So on top of all the fantasy gigs I've got going on and my real life job. It's been a little bit of a hectic week, so Matt and I weren't able to record on Monday. Darius is out of town, hopefully visiting Chuck at some point. And so I thought I'd bring Matt on this one. Matt, how are you?
I'm good, man. I think we need to make this podcast more of a priority in our lives. I mean, we got kids' birthdays. That's not good enough. But yeah. Darius going on vacation. I mean, you can't schedule vacations when you have podcasts.
No, not during the season. Vacation season after October.
You're going to have to change your kid's birthday, too. Find a different month. It's not baseball season.
Yeah, I mean, it's a surprise. I wasn't able to schedule that one better.
Yeah. How dare you?
Joining us today is a very special guest. We have Todd Zola from Masters Ball and RotorWire. Todd, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here, fellas.
Todd, why don't you tell people a little bit about yourself? I'm sure everybody listens to the Fantasy Baseball Podcast to know who you are, but tell people a little bit about yourself, where you can reach on social media, and then all the great work you do over at Masters Ball and at RotorWire.
Well, I guess I've been doing this as my full-time job for a few years now. Came from the scientific background, but when science didn't want me back, I had to do something. So, yeah, you mentioned Masters Ball. It's kind of the home base. I am a freelance writer. I write for ESPN. And do my own little platinum package over there at Masters Ball. I'm on Twitter at Todd Zola, TODDZOLA. I'm kind of a jerk. I don't usually answer questions on Twitter, mainly because I need more than 140 characters. But I will answer any question posed to me in any of the articles that I write. And if you don't subscribe to either of those sites, if you post them on the Masters Ball forum, I will answer. So I'm kind of a jerk about answering on Twitter, but I'm pretty good about answering everywhere else. So that's kind of the deal there. But unfortunately, RotoWire is subscription content. ESPN, I do the daily notes, which is free, and I do just some insider DFS stuff for them. And then the platinum package, you can find me. It's kind of late in the season to be pushing it, but I do projections and that sort of stuff, profiles, and we service a lot of NFBC people because we're out so early with our stuff, and we've got a long string of NFBC champions that have been subscribers. So whether they use the stuff or not, I don't know, but they give me a little bit of money. So I guess they do, I guess they try.
Well, we'll definitely have you back on for the NFBC kind of prep season in a few months because baseball has a quick turnaround, especially with NFBC leagues drafting super early.
Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, there's actually one league that I'm in. We actually start drafting the last week of the season, literally.
Wow. That's masochistic.
Well, we call it the Premature Edraftulation League.
that's a good name though. I like that.
Yeah, well, that's what we call it, the Premature Edraftulation. And we always want to start like as the day after the season ends, but somebody, can't we start now? So the guy that runs it says, "Well, listen, Yeah, we can start now. If you're on the clock, you don't have to make a pick. But, you know, if you want to, whatever. So, of course, you know, the peer pressure, whatever. Why aren't you picking? Well, it's, you know, it's the season's not over. You know, whatever. So, yeah, it's a blast. I mean, I'm actually doing that league, partnering with my my RotoWire podcast partner, Derek Van Riper. So it's kind of fun to, I don't do very many leagues with partners. So it's kind of fun to, you know, get a different perspective when you do that sort of thing.
Nice. Well, I'll definitely be looking forward to the results of that one. I always find it interesting, kind of really early ADP kind of things. So definitely be checking that out, as well as all your work over at RotoWire and Masters Ball. And speaking of people who are awful on Twitter, but for different reasons, Chuck can be found on Twitter at Just Chucking It. Matt can be found on Twitter at MDTompFWFB.
Are you trying to tell me I don't tweet enough?
No, I just, you tweet horribly.
Yeah, I'm guilty of that.
And then I can be reached on Twitter at Justin Mason FWFB.
I don't answer questions, but I do tweet out stuff, and it's not all baseball. I mean, some people think it's kind of funny, so I'm not a bad follow. It's just beware, I probably won't be answering your question.
I mostly fight with my wife on Twitter, which people seem to really love. She's being followed by like 300 people, and most of them are either listeners, readers, or fantasy baseball industry people. So, which is really fun.
That's better than me, Justin. I basically fight with everyone on Twitter. So,
you fight with yourself on Twitter.
I said everyone.
You fight with yourself in your of note column too sometimes.
That's a good point.
All right, let's jump in and talk about some players that need to be discussed, some guys maybe we haven't touched on recently or enough. It's getting to the end of the season. You know, when you have been doing this for four-plus months, it feels like, and if you go all the way back to when we started at the beginning of January, we're now looking at 8 months, 9 months. I've talked, you know, 2 to 3 days a week on this podcast for 9 months about players. So we're running out of options at some point. You don't want to repeat yourselves. So, but Chuck had an interesting one he wanted to talk about first, and that's Ozzie Albies. And we haven't really talked about him since he got his call-up. So, Chuck, tell me why you wanted to speak about Ozzie Albies.
Well, as of like 2 weeks ago, which I think is still a correct statement, he's the youngest prospect to get called up. He feeds into something I've covered in my of note columns, that I believe that people are having a bit of suffering shortstop / middle infield prospect fatigue, because a lot of them have been completely unpredictable in how they're going to grow. You know, look at Xander Bogaerts, you know, ever wavering home run total as Exhibit A. And for some reason or another, and talking about really early draft results, all the other prospects went off the board pretty early in our three-sport league, and I got Ozzie Albies as my second-to-last bat, which sort of stunned me. Now, I have long, trying to make this as short as I can, although I could ramble on for quite a while, I've spoken to Rich Wilson, I've spoken to Keith Law, I even believe I've mentioned it to Matt Thompson, that there is no such thing as accuracy in predicting these middle infielders and their offensive growth. I mean, look at the growth for Arcia between last year and this year. You know, and all of a sudden, you're talking about a 20-year-old kid. All of a sudden, he's had a mini power outbreak this year, and he's always ran. So I do understand that nobody wants to draft him in the first five rounds, but I don't understand why people don't want to draft him in the next 10. That makes no sense to me whatsoever. It's a great ballpark. The Braves have nothing in his way, nor should they have anything in his way. With as miserable as that team is right now, they should let him play. And I disagree with all the negative things I'm reading about Ozzie Albies going forward.
Todd, what are your thoughts on Ozzie Albies?
Well, when you say next 10, are you talking a rookie draft or sort of a standard mixed league? You want him in the 6th to 10th round?
Oh, I'm talking about in a standard league, I think he should go before round 15 is what I'm saying.
Well, 12 or 15 team mixed?
Correct.
Nah, that's way too early. honestly. You're projecting. There's still good players going at that point that have established themselves. And, I mean, he may have the upside. I'm actually hearing comparisons to Jose Altuve. Let's slow the roll there a little bit anyway. And you're right about the projectability. The comparison there is just because of the size. He's a diminutive guy. But let's slow the roll. I mean, 15th rounder in a 15-team league, I mean, that's a regular player. And he's maybe has that potential. Maybe I want to put him on a reserve. But that's jumping the gun way too soon. I mean, it's the comparison. I mean, say what Carlos Correa did, it's not the same player. But I mean, if Correa can have an off year his second year, let's slow it down. We haven't seen Albies run yet. I think we will. I think that has more to do with where he's hitting in the batting order, hitting down towards the bottom, and they're just not as likely to run at this point until they get a little more confidence and that sort of thing. But like the player, I think we're pushing it to say he's a top, you know, 225 player next, going into next year.
Matt, you're a prospect guy. What are your thoughts on Albies?
Well, I think from a real baseball standpoint, I mean, he's going to be a hell of a player in the long term. I mean, being 20 years old, like Chuck mentioned, the youngest player called up to the major leagues, there's always a considerably successful track record of guys that are the youngest call-ups. And to be called up at age 20, which keep in mind, the draft just happened in June, he wouldn't even be draft eligible at 20 years old if he was a college student. So just take all the numbers and everything for into comparison. I mean, his AAA numbers don't jump off the page. But then you got to remember, he's 20 years old, hitting .285 in AAA with 9 homers and 21 stolen bags. And his numbers throughout his minor league career really haven't been that eye-popping, unless you got to consider the age. He's a high contact hitter, so he's going to be high batting averages. The contact percentage and the stolen bases and the size, I get the Jose Altuve comparisons, but the power is not going to be to that level. But he's starting to grow into that power. 9 home runs this year, 21 doubles in AAA, 8 triples, and then even in the major leagues, he's already got 11 extra base hits and 88 at-bats. That's a lot more than, most 20-year-olds would be able to get with his size especially. So I think he's going to surprise people with the power. That being said, the Atlanta Braves don't run very much. They're in the bottom third in stolen base attempts. Mm-hmm. So I'm a little bit worried about his stolen base output. I think he's ultimately a type of player that could get 30 steals annually, but it might take him 45 attempts to do so. And I don't think the Braves would allow him to do that. I think the move to second base kind of hurts his value a little bit with Dansby at short. I like Albies, but I think we need to pump the brakes a little bit. He's going to be a fantastic player, but I think he's going to be one of those guys that's a way better real-life player than he is fantasy asset.
Yeah, I think Chuck may be drinking a little bit of his own Kool-Aid after taking him in our 3 sports draft for next season. A little bit higher on him than I would be. I mean, I love the fact that he's in the major leagues at such a young age, that the Braves weren't afraid to bring him up at the age of 20. But, this is still a super, super young guy, and I think maybe we need to look over onto the other side of the diamond to his teammate Dansby Swanson to see a guy that was maybe brought up a little bit too quickly and struggled and has struggled mightily this year, though he's looked a little bit better since coming back up from the minors. Prospects can struggle early on, and just because they hit the ground running at one point doesn't mean they're going to not going to struggle later. Todd mentioned Carlos Correa's first full season after kind of blowing the doors off the hinges in his first cup of coffee at the major league level. I like Albies long term. I think he can be like a 10-30 guy at some point in his career, but I agree with Matt. I don't think that this is necessarily going to be a guy that's going to jump into that straight away. And I think projecting that and projecting what the Braves lineup is going to look like around him next year and in the future is kind of a foolhardy errand. I don't think he is a top 200 player coming into next year, and I will rank him as such. Let's talk about Blake Parker, because Blake Parker is starting to get some saves. And speaking of a foolhardy errand, it may be kind of foolhardy to try to predict who's going to be getting saves in Anaheim. So, Todd, what are your thoughts on Blake Parker, and will he be closing rest of the way?
No, it's not actually foolhardy. It's there's actually a pattern. They don't pitch Cam Bedrosian 2 days in a row. Bedrosian's the closer. If he hasn't pitched the day before, he will get the save opportunity. Now, the difference is a couple weeks ago, we weren't sure who number two is. Now we're pretty sure. Well, the last two times, it's been Blake Parker. Parker's had better. He's been the best skills guy in their bullpen all season long. But he just hasn't, you know, they use Norris and all these other things. So I think, you know, I don't think he will overtake Bedrosian because I still think they see Bedrosian as the guy for next year. And they just want to nurse him through the rest of this season, even though they've sort of snuck. Well, you know, they haven't nearly snuck back into the wild card. Everybody thinks it's so cool. The American League, there's so many teams, you know, in the wild card. It's just there's so many bad teams in the American League that they're all in the wild card hunt. But that's beside the point. You know, can he overtake? Can Bedrosian get hurt? Can something like that happen? Sure. But I still think Bedrosian's the guy, but they're just not pitching him back-to-back.
Matt, what are your thoughts on Blake Parker?
Well, Blake Parker, the player, I mean, he's always been – he's a reliever, relief prospect all the way. He used to be a Cubs prospect, a high strikeout guy in the minor leagues at every level. And I think Todd nailed it, though. I mean, I think he's the benefactor of being in the right place at the right time. And with Mike Socha – kind of does weird things, and with Bedrosian not being able to pitch every other day, on back-to-back days, Parker's going to – he's the second guy. I mean, he's – if you're in a saves and hold league, I'm sure he's already owned by now with the numbers he's been putting up. But down the stretch of where we're at now, I mean, I play regrettably in mostly head-to-head leagues, unfortunately. So to pick up the spare save or two, he might be a guy that might add because, I mean, he's better than – streaming a lot of these crappy starters that are going to come up down the stretch. Why not get a guy who might only pitch, you know, four innings a week for you, but he can get you 7 Ks in a save. You know what I'm saying? On a good week. I mean, I think that's reasonable. So I think he's a player that in a deeper league, you might take a flyer on, but just keep your expectations severely in check. And he should be the last guy on your roster. Kind of like the first guy you cut for the next sexy call up, like a Jack Flaherty or something, but you can ride out Parker for the handful of saves you might get.
Chuck, what are your thoughts?
Well, he's 32 years old. You know, the 11.39 K per nine is certainly eye-popping, and he's only given up a run in one of his last 20 appearances, which, you know, I definitely, you know, he's definitely pitching well enough to be used even if he wasn't getting saves. So I understand the interest in him right now, but I also agree that I don't see a lot of value moving forward. I really don't trust the Angels as an organization with anybody who throws a ball attempting to put it over the plate and not get schmucked all over the place. And I don't trust Mike Socha at all. He's probably the last manager I would want for my team in all of Major League Baseball. So therefore, it's hard for me to get excited about him long term. But as a sort of a Band-Aid here to sort of hopefully pitch in maybe 3-4 more saves the rest of the season, I get where that can be useful in tight races, in stats, in different categories the rest of the season.
I dislike Mike Socha, but I would trade him for my team's manager any day.
I wouldn't trade my team's manager for both those guys.
Yeah.
Blake Parker, I think he is an interesting guy rest of the way, depending on what your format is. And in leagues deep enough where every closer is already owned, obviously he has, you know, there's some level of interest because he might get a save or two, like Matt mentioned. But also in leagues that have game started limits. I mean, he's a guy that can really kind of, you know, maybe help nail down some ratios for you, supplement some strikeouts. And if you're closing in on like a 200 game started limit, which I've gotten a number of leagues that I'm approaching, especially where I've been streaming a lot. He's a guy that maybe can help make up the fact that you won't be able to start some starters down the stretch. So I think Blake Parker, while he probably is not going to close every day unless something happens to Bedrosian, I think he's a guy that maybe we're discounting a little bit too much because we're not thinking about the fact that I think a lot of leagues go with either game started or innings started limits. Or maximums, though I can't stand inning started maximums. But so I think he's a guy that if you're looking for help in the ratios, you're looking for help in some strikeouts, but you can't start starters all the time, I think he's a good guy to kind of plug into your lineup rest of the way.
He's probably already gone in those leagues, though. But you're right. Like, you know, in a mixed league where you got seven starters and two closers, and once in a while you want that third closer to try to chase saves or whatever because you don't like the matchup. He's, you know, I can see in a shuttle league where he's that guy you use as your third closer too.
Mm-hmm. I'm actually going to check and see. I forgot to make pickups. I believe someone just picked him up in our three-sport league that's finishing up this year. So let's go ahead and move on and talk about one of Matt's guys because he is a St. Louis Cardinal. Matt, what are your thoughts on Colton Wong so far this season and rest of the way?
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, the reason why I put him on here was to kind of gauge what you three thought about Colton Wong. Because, I mean, I think he's a batting average guy this year so far with the 310 average and the 392 OBP. I played in majority OBP leagues. That's been extremely nice. He's had a very consistent walk rate throughout his career. It's up at 9.4% now. It was 9.4% last year as well. So he's shown growth in that compared to his first 2 years of his career, which were down by around the 5% mark. He's not striking out a lot either. And he's just not – he's getting the volume of at-bats and stuff, but he's just not doing anything with it sexy counting number-wise, but the home runs and the stolen bases are a little bit lighter than you would think they would be. You watch Colton Wong and – He hit a home run this week that was, you know, you would think with the way it looked, you know, that he'd be a guy that's capable of 10 to 12 home runs consistently like he did in 14 and 15. But I don't know why the power hasn't been there. The extra base hits are there, the double totals and stuff, but I don't know why the home run pop isn't there. But the stolen base attempts, I wanted to touch on that. The Cardinals don't run. He had two stolen bases in a game last week, so I was kind of hoping that he would, you know, kind of try to run a little more. I know he was caught stealing again once last week too, so he has started to run a little more. I say down the stretch here, but so I guess he might be a cheap source of a steal or two in head-to-head formats that can win you your league, but I'm not very high on him as you guys might think I would be. I just kind of wanted to gauge where you guys are at.
Todd, where are you at on Colton Wong?
The problem with Colton Wong isn't necessarily Colton Wong. It's the Cardinals have just such a huge logjam in the infield. And we don't know how it's going to flesh out. I mean, they've still got Eledmus Diaz down on the farm, you know, sort of the in timeout for a little while, and it's been for a lot of while because DeJong's just gone nuts. So it's playing, and they don't get him consistent playing time. The past two seasons, he's going to end up with fewer than 400 plate appearances. A lot of that's because he gets such a short leash when he's in there, and if they have another guy, and when you get a guy like Matt Carpenter that can play every position but shortstop, you can bring up Voit, you can do different things to try to find the combination that works. So I mean the player, he's not great. I mean, you know, listen, that's next year, am I taking Wong or Albies, you know, as a flyer? I'd take the upside on Albies. I think I can yeah. say that, but unless he's sort of the guy though that if he starts out with the job and he hits early, I can see where he just takes it and runs with it. I don't know whether, you know, well, Peralta's gone. I would say he was part of the logjam, but they still got, you know, DeJong's now added to it. He'll come, you know, the pixie dust will wear off at some point, but they still have, you know, Diaz and Jerko and Carpenter, and you know, there still is a bit of a logjam. You're right, he's not running, but what's weird is, you say he got caught. He's still, you know, 6 out of 8, you know, 75% still fine. Last year was, you know, perfect in 7 chances. Some, you know, nowadays, especially when you're successful, they let you run more. They kind of, you know, if you're able to run, they let you run because they're so aware of that 70 to 75% success mm-hmm. rate in order to continue running. But the other hand, he too has been hitting down lower in the order. Lately, he's been hitting up higher, but he too is hitting down lower, and you just don't run. So I don't know. I mean, for whatever reason, I don't know. They trade somebody or you know, something happens, and I feel confident that Wong is the second baseman for the entire season. He's now of interest, but I just don't know I just don't know about the playing time out there.
We were talking about like situations where teams run. I think you'd be shocked to know the Cardinals average more stolen base attempts per game than the Braves do. Which I thought was kind of interesting because we talk about Albies and Wong and their stolen base potential. The Cardinals actually run a smidge more than the Braves do.
But that's not really saying much either.
No, it's not. No, they're both comfortably toward the bottom, but mm-hmm. it's just, you know.
Chuck, what's your thought on Wong?
Well, I guess my thoughts are, you know, for the last few years, I follow Cardinals fans on Twitter, and for the last few years, all I've heard about is give him some more leash, let him play, let him play, let him play. And now we get this giant thud. Okay, and he is getting saved by the fact that he's got a 310 batting average and, you know, the 390 OBP, et cetera. But he also has a 360 BABIP to achieve that, which seems, I mean, he isn't going to be a higher BABIP guy, but it's certainly easy to see him losing 30 points on that BABIP at some point or another. And if he was only hitting 280, how excited would you be about anything that we've seen so far? And I think all the perspectives here have been really good. I mean, I think Todd's exactly right that Lord only knows what's going to happen. They certainly need to upgrade their offense next year. You know, they're not going to play the Brewers every night and Matt Garza. So they need to upgrade their offense in general. And, you know, I think Matt's right, too, that it seems like there's more here. I mean, when he hits home runs, it seems like he hammers them. You know, when you watch him play, he plays with excellent speed in reality. So it seems like there's a lot more here than what there is. But I was also going to say I would prefer Albies right now to Wong because of all these different perspectives combined. You don't know exactly how much he's going to play, and you're not certain that he's going to be good. I mean, now you can't bank on a 310 batting average when 2 years ago he hit 230 or whatever it was. So what are you banking on? Is the hard part. And when there's also a question about role, that makes it a hard guy to really put much draft capital into.
Yeah, I think one of the common themes of what you guys have been talking about is the fact that it's really difficult to trust Mike Matheny rest of the way, much less moving into next season. And I don't want to play that game. You know, it was one of the things I talked about Tommy Pham is, you know, the Cardinals seem to, for some reason, dislike him in previous seasons, though he's getting a ton of run now, and obviously he seems like he may be a starter for next season. But considering the Cardinals will go out and buy people, yeah. they're not a small market team. They're a team that wants to compete every year. It wouldn't be surprising to see them go out and trade for a second baseman or add a second baseman through free agency, and so. Any chance of Wong getting some sort of full-time playing time is likely diminished if the Cardinals feel like they can address that hole. So I liked Wong at one point. I thought he was going to turn into a 20-home-run bat at the position with a decent average and chip in, you know, 15-plus steals. But I think those days, unfortunately, have passed us, even though he is only going to be 27 entering next year.
It's interesting because, you know, the Cardinals talked a big game about being more athletic this offseason and heading into this year and focusing on defense. He's by far the best defensive infielder. Obviously, he's only limited to second base, but he's just now getting regular at-bats because he's been performing well. While the whole season he was kind of playing, he would sit two out of every five games or so. He's finally getting regular at-bats and he's producing, so I hope he gets the job going forward. Maybe next year he's a guy you can add toward the back end of your draft to get something out of.
And, I mean, maybe he's a guy that Cardinals look to move next year.
I
know the contract might make it a little bit harder, but it's not like they're paying him a ton of money on a year-to-year basis. You know, he's only owed $4 million next year, 6.5 in 2019 and 10.2 in 2020. So, I mean, those aren't necessarily cost-prohibitive numbers to move a guy.
He would look like Ryan Sandberg on the aforementioned Anaheim Angels right now, wouldn't he? I mean, they're starting Blake Cowart, and they've given Pennington a run. I mean, I think there's fit for him around the league, especially if St. Louis was willing to chip in any of that money against that contract.
Yeah, I think that is a fair point. Let's move on and talk about a guy who is pretty underowned and. for good reason, but when you search the ESPN player rater by the last, I think, either 7 or 15 days, an interesting name pops up, and that's Kyle Gibson, who's been hot as of late. Two straight quality starts, both were wins, where he struck out at least seven guys in both starts. So, Todd, what are your thoughts on Kyle Gibson? Can he be a useful fantasy player rest of the way?
No. Now listen, everybody has a couple of good games. I mean, he ran into a couple of good starts. He caught the White Sox, who were terrible, and Toronto, a hit or miss sort of team. But no, listen, look at every pitcher, and it's usually when I stack against them in DFS. But look at every pitcher, and they'll have a couple of good starts. Now, listen, he's on a good team. Well, not on a good team. He's on a team that's scoring some runs. If you're chasing wins, I can see using a Kyle Gibson. But I don't look at a guy that has the track record that he has. And just because even on the road, he's thrown a couple of good games together, that he's suddenly the guy. He doesn't walk people in general. He doesn't give up a whole lot of home runs in general, but he gives up a ton of hard contact. So I don't know. I'm not running out to get Gibson because he's had a couple of good starts.
Chuck, are you running out to go get Kyle Gibson?
I don't think I would admit that publicly, even if I was, actually. But the point is, he's got a 5.05 FIP this year. When I look at him statistically, what really jumped out to me is that in 2015, he had a 3.84 ERA with an 11.4 home run to fly ball rate. Now, this year, his home run to fly ball rate is 18.3%. That 7% jump is a really, really big deal. You know, he also pitched, got close to 200 innings back in 2015. I don't like his situation. I don't like how things are trending. He hasn't walked more than two guys in a start this month, which walks have definitely. I mean, if you're going to strike out less than seven guys per nine, you definitely don't want to walk almost four guys per nine. And that's what we've had so far this year in its totality, but he's been much better lately. I need to see a lot more than this before I would get excited. And I can't imagine a scenario where I would want him as more than my last reserve pick in any format next year.
Matt, what are your thoughts on Kyle Gibson?
He's not very good, but he's been on a roll, I guess you could say, for him, especially the last two starts has been pretty nice. I know we're getting down to the end of the season here, and kind of had a discussion with like Chris Towers of CBS on this very subject a little bit, because you're wondering why the Mariners would be willing to take on Mike Leake's contract when you can get someone like Miguel Gonzalez, admittedly who's terrible, for the stretch run instead for probably nothing, because he's going to be a free agent next year. And it kind of the thought process came. If I was the Mariners, I would have rather had Gonzalez, because even though, you know he's probably a worse pitcher than Leake, he's been performing better this year by just raw stats. The underlying stats say that he's not better, but you know what I mean? The peripheral stats are so worse, but the ERA and the wins, he's getting quality starts and stuff that he shouldn't be getting. I think this is kind of where you're at here, because in fantasy you get desperate toward the last month of the season. Head-to-head leagues, whatever. Just to take a look at who the – I kind of mapped out his starts for the next – three or four outings. It looks like he's going to catch Kansas City at home. He's going to get Tampa Bay at Tampa. And then he's going to catch the Padres at home. And then the Blue Jays at home. So he might be worth using for down the stretch here, to be honest with you. We're getting to that point of this fantasy season where you kind of have to look at the schedule. You're going to want to drop him after that, because then you got the Yankees and the Indians on the road. But you don't want to face those. But, the last fantasy month of the season has – caused me to track Kyle Gibson starts. So, you can see how desperate some people might be as far as, trying to get an edge or two. But normally I would say no, but he's got a very, very favorable schedule coming up down the stretch for him.
That's a really nice point, and I didn't realize how – I knew his next two starts were looking good, but I didn't go any farther than that. I've been – like Matthew Berry a long time ago on his old now changed around the cast fantasy baseball podcast over on Fantasy Focus on ESPN, coined a term, a fantasy kryptonite, a guy that you were powerless over not taking in drafts, ended up on your team every year. I need a term for a guy like Kyle Gibson, because Kyle Gibson's a guy I've fallen for on too many occasions and just has never panned out, and there's no reason I should keep falling for it. But for some reason, I do, and I did again this year, because he looked good in spring training and made some mechanical adjustments, and I drafted him in deeper formats, in AL only, and in my NFBC 50 round draft and hold. I like what Matt said in terms of using him kind of while he's a little bit hot right now, while he's got a nice little schedule, but. Yeah, at some point I got to cut the cord and just be like, Kyle Gibson just is not that good and has not shown enough at the major league level, really at any point in his career, to warrant being rostered outside of AL-only leagues. So,
yeah, I'm not saying he's good either, but
he wasn't good. So I think that is a very fair analysis. Let's move on to someone who has been really, really good, and that's Rhys Hoskins. Now, on the radio show that I do, the Tout Wars Hour that Todd's on every week, Matt's on a bunch, that I do with Laura Michaels over at Fantasy Radio Network, when Rhys Hoskins got the call-up, I made what I thought was a really, really bold prediction, that Rhys Hoskins could hit 10 to 12 home runs rest of the way. I had no idea how much I was short-sailing it. So, Matt, what are your thoughts on Rhys Hoskins and the amazing kind of power show he's put on over the course of his, 19, 20 games at the major league level? And where are your thoughts on him for next year?
For next year, he's going to be massively overvalued, and unfortunately, he's priced himself out of being on any of my teams. What Hoskins is, to me, he's a 35 home run bat down the line as soon as next year. I'm sorry about the dog, guys.
Obviously a Rhys Hoskins fan.
Yeah, it doesn't like my take on him. Might be a Tommy Joseph fan.
Or he's a Kyle Gibson fan.
Mm-hmm. A Tommy Joseph fan maybe too. Who knows? But I guess the thing with Hoskins, he's a 35 homer bat that's playing right now like a 60 homer bat. So obviously, that's not sustainable on any level. But he's also, people are underlooking the approach is solid. And the hit tool is, I would say, even average. So, I mean, you look at Hoskins going forward, I mean, I think a good debate for next year to kind of gauge where Hoskins is going to be, I think he's going to be around 12th ranked first baseman for me, probably off rough hand. I haven't really done the rankings yet, but who would you rather have next year? Like a guy like Rhys Hoskins or like an Eric Thames? I think they're going to be valued kind of similarly. And I think I would take Hoskins in that, with that in mind, but I've been really shocked with what Hoskins is doing. I mean, I like him coming when he got promoted, and I thought, he's going to be successful. But, I mean, anyone that saw this coming is lying to you. But, I mean, he's been outstanding and probably saved a lot of people's seasons as far as fantasy. And the added bonus of outfield eligibility, which I didn't think he would ever have, is going to be nice too.
Todd, what are your thoughts on Hoskins?
I think, one thing, just take a look. He's got 11 homers, but he's got two doubles. And it's basically whether it's a couple of gusts of winds or whatever, that's gonna equilibrate, that's gonna normalize or whatever you want to call it. He obviously has power. He's hit more homers in the minors the past couple of years than anybody else. The power is indisputable. He may not have been as sexy a prospect as some other guys because of the position that he plays. And I don't want to call it looking at me for me to call someone with a sloppy body is kind of funny, but he doesn't have that prospect glow, that some other guys do, even though he's been hitting all those homers. I think he's fine. I like the contact rate a lot. I like the approach. I heard someone mention, he's even been unlucky. Look at that BABIP, which I don't remember exactly what it is at this point, but it's in the low 200s. You got to keep in mind that, especially in a short sample, when somebody's got so many homers don't count in the BABIP. Mm-hmm. But if those homers were doubles, because they were hit pretty hard, now suddenly the BABIP goes up. So don't fool yourself into thinking, geez, if he had a normal BABIP, he'd even be hitting 330. It's kind of baked into the short sample and hitting so many homers that it's an artificially low BABIP just based on that. Look at the hard hit data. I don't know. I haven't done my rankings yet. You say 12. I don't know. I honestly don't know where he would come out just because, first base is a pretty deep position. Mm-hmm. But, I assume that he'll have the job over Tommy Joseph. I don't see him playing outfield full time. Joseph kind of played just well enough that it's not a no-brainer, but yet Hoskins would be an upgrade. So, yeah, I'm interested. If he has, I don't know that he'll have outfield eligibility in some of the leagues that I'll play in. I'm trying to, what he's got. Yeah, he might. He's got 17 now. If he gets to 20, I'm a lot more interested if I could flip him between first base and outfield, although he may not even get first base eligibility next year. He'll probably be outfield only. I'm a lot more interested then just because he still may get 20 down the stretch. I mean, depending on what they do with Joseph, or 16 more down the stretch. But the point being, I like him more at outfield only because there's more flexibility. There's more room for, margin for error, replacement. I like him, you know, whatever. But still, I think part of it is we kind of, I don't want to say ignored him, but he didn't get the prospect allure that some of these other sexier guys did if he probably should have. I think he probably should have been higher on some prospect lists than he was.
Well, I think there is a real chance that he does get both eligibilities by the end of the season for next year. There's already a report that when both Aaron Altair and Odubel Herrera return on Friday, and they're both expected to return on Friday, he will move to first base. And Tommy Joseph becomes more of a bench bat rest of the way. So I think there is a real chance he does get both eligibilities, which makes him a very interesting guy. But I'm seeing people in the industry on Twitter talk about how they're going to take him as a top 10 first baseman next year. And I just think this is a really, really foolhardy mistake that people are making. A little bit too much recency bias that people are just enamored with the hot stretch that he's on. I mean, these kind of hot stretches sometimes happen. I don't think he's a garbage player by any means, and I do think the power is somewhat legitimate. Obviously, he's not a 50-60 home run bat, but, I mean, I think people are going a little bit insane in terms of an idea that maybe he deserves to be in the top 10, top 12, because I think, like Todd mentioned, first base is much deeper than we thought it was coming into the year, especially with pop-up guys gaining first base eligibility throughout the year. I can't imagine he's going to be in my top 15 first baseman. Looking at guys like that popped up, like Justin Smoke, you got to imagine is probably going to be in most people's top 15. Gurriel has got first base eligibility. Joey Gallo's got first base eligibility. You know, maybe he's in the Eric Thames argument, but I think, you know, you still have Matt Carpenter, who is not performing like a top 15, top 12 first baseman, and I think most people are going to still put back in there. Still got Brandon Belt, which some people are apologists for, Ian Desmond. I mean, there's just too many guys that are going to have first base eligibility for me to give a guy who's really going to have only had a two-month sample at the major league level thrown right back in there just because of a hot streak. Chuck, what are your thoughts on Rhys Hoskins?
Well, I like the perspectives given here a lot, but one thing that hasn't been mentioned is I've noticed that the Phillies have dropped Mikel Franco significantly in their batting order in recent weeks. I think they're kind of losing patience with him. And one thing I like is if you're going to take a gamble, I want that gamble to be, you know, able to really pay off. And I don't see another bat on their roster that really should hit cleanup or third in the base run production positions. I want you to compare in your head him to Castellanos. Okay. Castellanos was never going to be able to bat third, fourth, or fifth until the creaky old legs and the irregular heartbeat of Victor Martinez and Miguel Cabrera and JD Martinez, until all those bats got out of his way. There's no one in Rhys Hoskins' way. So I'm woefully cannot resist position eligibility when I draft my NFBC teams, because I love the idea of being able to cover multiple positions and maybe draft one more pitcher that I could hit on later in the draft. And I am likely to be that guy that is a little bit too high on Hoskins. I don't think he's a top 10 first baseman, but going forward, I think he's a little closer to it than has been presented here. That plate approach, that plate discipline in the minors that has held true so far is a wonderful foreboding. It's one of the things that I rely on the most.
All right. Let's talk about John Gray, because John Gray missed much of the season to injury, but is pitching well as of late and maybe starting to kind of get things going after a slow start after returning from injury. Todd, what are your thoughts on John Gray rest this year and then looking into next season?
No, I like him. I mentioned a little while ago that not here, but on one of my platforms, that I thought he'd have a strong second half. And it doesn't have to go out on a limb to say that sort of thing. You know, he came back from the injury. I still am not as high on him. As well as he did in Coors last year, it's still Coors Field, and it's still Pummel's pitching. So I'm not going to be the guy that wants to be so smart to take the guy in Coors Field that's able to defeat it again. So I'm not going to be on John Gray. you know, but I think we're seeing what we're going to see. You know, we're seeing the John Gray we expected. He's the guy that I expected coming into the season at this point. He just had the injury, obviously, in between. But I'm just it's a bias, it's a stigma. I don't want to be the guy to be known. I don't want to be the guy to be known that I was so smart that John Gray was better than Coors Field. I'd rather be known as the guy that was too dumb to draft John Gray, and not, you know, whatever. Because more often than not, the dumb guy is going to be right.
Chuck, you've been a Coors apologist of sorts, kind of projecting that at some point there will be pitchers that figure out kind of how to pitch in Coors. Is John Gray one of those guys that you really like?
Well, I think he does hint at the fact that it could be done. I mean, I'm afraid to use any of his statistics from this year because to me, after the long break, really his first four or five starts were, to me, almost like spring training again. But at the same time, he's got a 4.96 ERA on the road and a 3.0 ERA at home. And his ERA was better at home last year than it was on the road. And to put my apologies in perspective, I'm never a believer that the numbers are going to even out. I don't mean it that way. I just mean that if you put an all-star team worth of pitchers in Coors, they would still be usable because they would be out-pitching everybody else at Coors, regardless of you know, regardless. You put Clayton Kershaw in Coors, Clayton Kershaw is still a usable pitcher. I don't care what anyone says. Okay, and they have time over time to try and develop pitching. And to be honest with you, I think Colorado and the things that they've done this year, I think people aren't paying enough attention to the fact that their pitching has been very competitive, especially at home, for this historic view of what we've had in Coors. You know, John Gray is a guy that I think has outstanding stuff. His stuff looks better than he's pitched to this point because he hasn't really figured out the truest form of consistency yet. I do think he'll get there eventually. I'm a little bit higher on him than it sounds like Todd is, because I would be willing to take him if I could get him as my, you know, late fourth, early fifth starter. And, you know, even if I have to mitigate where I use him or which home starts I use him for, there I think maybe I can make up for it if I'm aggressive in the reserve rounds, etc. I see the points that everybody makes about John Gray. I just think I think his future might be a little brighter than most people think.
Matt, what are your thoughts on John Gray?
I like John Gray going forward. I have him in a dynasty league. The thing is, the strikeouts are a little bit down this year, which kind of worries me, with strikeouts being up across the game. I know we had injury concerns, so I'm willing to chalk it up to that, but they're down a strikeout per nine innings, which isn't an insignificant number. And as far as Coors is going, I know it's not home runs and anything like that, but home runs are actually down for Gray on a per nine basis. BABIP's up, though, because that's what Coors is. Coors is actually, you know, the bigger gaps and stuff is what the problem with Coors is, with the elevation and the bigger gaps, and it actually will lead to more doubles and triples, really, than anything else. So that's still kind of got him there. But I still believe in John Gray. I think he's got the talent. I think if John Gray, the better question is if John Gray pitched with, you know, on a competitive team in a good ballpark, I think he's one of the top 15 to 20 pitchers in fantasy based on all that stuff. But I mean, he's in Coors, so you have to bake that into the price where you pay for him. I still think he's a good pitcher, and I'm not afraid to own him down the line or anything like that. So I'm kind of right in the middle of Chuck and Todd as far as my Coors Field thoughts. But I think talent ultimately shines through no matter where you pitch. Coors is going to be Coors, though, and no one's going to outpitch the ballpark. It's next to Father Time. It's pretty much the only undefeated thing in fantasy, right? I mean, you don't beat Coors Field as a pitcher too often anyways. So, you know, I still like John Gray.
I like John Gray, too. Oh, go ahead, Todd.
As far as the Coors thing, the fact that the run environment in baseball is up softens my stance a little bit, because I think he's going to do what he's going to do. I don't think he's going to do worse with the run environment being up. But his actual ERA isn't, you know, compared to, you know, the norm or the other, you know, where you are in the standings, it's not as bad now that the ERAs are up 0.2, 0.3 runs in general. It's still, you know, relatively speaking, it's still – I don't know, a little high. And the other thing too is I play. We mentioned NFBC. I play a lot of NFBC, and as you guys know, they love to pay for the strikeouts. So and they sometimes strikeouts come with baggage. And he's a guy that people will overpay for strikeouts. So part of my thinking is baked into that too. Is I don't really want to overpay for strikeouts, and he's one of those guys that falls into that category. So anyway, I'll let you wrap it up, Justin.
Yeah, I just think that there's kind of a Coors discount that you sometimes get with guys like John Gray. We weren't necessarily getting it early on in draft season because I think a lot of people were a little high on Gray before he was hurt. So I think coming into this year, he may be one of those kind of forgotten guys. I know he went in the 41st round of our 3-sport draft, around the same area as Dan Straley and Jason Vargas and pitchers of that ilk. So I think if he becomes a little bit of a forgotten man and people maybe discount him because he's in Coors, then I'm going to be all over that because I do think he can be a useful pitcher. Since the All-Star break, he's got a 3.10 ERA. That includes 5 starts at home in Coors Field. He's got just a little bit less than a strikeout an inning during that time, and right about two walks per 9. I think he's starting to get starting to show health, and we all know he's had the skills to be a top tier pitcher. Just a really bad situation pitching in Colorado. So Gray, I think, is a guy that will end up on a number of my teams next year if the price is right. But we have to kind of see where people are putting him in. ADPs tend to kind of gravitate around where industry folks rank him. So it'll be interesting to see where the industry as a whole places him. Let's move on, talk about Brandon Crawford. We'll move through maybe some of the last 4 guys a little bit more quickly to kind of get out of here on time. Crawford has had a pretty disappointing year. I mean, some might say it's Brandon Crawford in, but after hitting 21 home runs in 2015, and then numbers coming back down a little bit, but at least hitting .275, there were some people who thought maybe this was a guy who could rebound a little bit this year. He's been hot as of late. So Todd, give me your thoughts on Brandon Crawford.
I don't know, what you see is what you get, and it's expectation. And I think you're right that people assume everybody's going to improve over what they did the year before, whereas 70% of players actually get worse than they did the year before. It just turns out that the 21 homers was an outlier in 15, and the .275 was an outlier last year. You take those two out, and at the end of the season, he's going to be doing what he should be, low teens homers in an average, even if it stays in the .240 range. Other than .275, he was .246, .256, .248, so it's right in line. I think the difference is he's just not getting better. If people thought there was another level, that's not there. It's, next year, he's just in, we talked about Albies. I guess when it comes down to Crawford or Albies, do you want the floor of Crawford or the upside of Albies?
I think that's a good question. Chuck, what are your thoughts?
My thoughts are that I don't know exactly what to take of the Giants going forward. I guess I'm sort of putting it in a team perspective because I agree with Todd that Brandon Crawford is what Brandon Crawford is. He's a really slick fielding, very good reality player that does not hit the right, is always going to have significant flaws in his fantasy game. So my point is that I don't know where the Giants are going to upgrade their offense. But that offense needs upgrading really, really bad, not a little bit. And so I wonder where his role is going to be moving forward. I do think maybe he would have more value if he was hitting somewhere else. They're spending so much money on Matt Cain, spending so much money on guys that are, guys that aren't really helping the team. They've always been a dead money team. Even when they were winning World Series, they were paying the Aubrey Huffs of the world every year. But now they're an unsuccessful team that's got plenty of dead money around the diamond. And so are they going to spend money? What are they going to do? I think it lessens even further Brandon Crawford's ability to have sneaky value if things fall right, if the offense stays as putrid as it is right now. Jarrett Parker is not a middle of the lineup bat, but he is now in that situation. So we got to see exactly what the Giants do before I get very excited. I wouldn't want to own them for the rest of the season because obviously they're just kind of trying to tread water and see where they're going to what they're going to do going forward.
Yeah, Matt Cain's contract will come off the books. They'll pay out the buyout for his vesting option is on the books in 2018 because they're not going to pay him another $20 million, $21 million next year. And all reports are that the Giants, one, consider themselves to not need to go through a complete rebuild, but more of a reload. There was actually a rumor floating around yesterday that they'd inquired about Justin Upton via a waiver trade who had cleared waivers, but were worried about the fact that he's got an opt-out clause at the end of the year, and they wanted to be able to guarantee that he would not exercise that. So I think the Giants are a team that fancies themselves having the ability to jump back into the race next year. And the second point on Crawford and the Giants from a team perspective is when the Giants put virtually everybody up for sale at the trade deadline, Brandon Crawford was one of the non-starters, one of the three: Crawford, Bumgarner, and Posey. Crawford's defense is so good that they have no intention of moving him. They believe he is a cornerstone of that franchise. But I agree with Chuck and Todd in terms of his fantasy value. I just think that maybe we got a little more hyped about him because we saw some pieces in his game that improved dramatically overnight. We didn't bake into the fact that maybe that was his best season in 2015 and that he wouldn't necessarily get better. I think he's an interesting guy in NL only because you know he's going to get plate appearances and at-bats. You know he's going to be on the field as long as he's healthy. He's never going to sit because he's struggling at the plate because his defense is so good. So in deeper formats, that has value. 84 runs scored in 2015, 2016. He may get close to that this year with 64 runs with a month left in the RBIs with a month left in the season. So I think he's got some value in deeper formats, but in your traditional 10 or 12 team mixed leagues, he's better left for the waiver wire. Matt, what are your thoughts on Crawford?
I legit have nothing to add that you didn't already say. He's kind of a boring roster glue type of player in a deeper league. I'm curious to see the walk rates kind of collapse after the gains of the last, two out of the last 3 years, but he's getting a little snake bit by BABIP, but even if the BABIP falls to regulars, he's still a 260 hitter. I mean, you're not missing much. He's, like you said, at-bats are currency. So those deep leagues and those NL-only leagues, he's worth a lot more than he is for sure in any other format because he's going to play and he's not going to sit because of the defense. So I'm with you.
All right. Let's move on to Tanner Roark. Todd, what are your thoughts on Tanner Roark? He's had a little bit of a decent stretch as of late as well.
Basically, he's the same guy he's always been, and outcomes don't always – skill, the outcomes aren't always dictated directly by the skills. He's got the same skills as he's always had, and last year he helped teams. This year he's not helping teams. He's the kind of guy that you have to, take that chance, and you project the skills and see what happens. Like I said, everybody has a couple of hot starts. So, to me, Roark, again, is what he is. Over the course of an entire season, the numbers will balance out to be, not very good depending on your format. And I don't see a wavering too much from that.
Chuck, any thoughts on Roark?
I do think he's kind of fascinating in so much. I agree with Todd that it's hard to know exactly how the results are going to mirror the skills, but he is a guy that everyone sort of had painted a certain way, that the Nationals had screwed with him by moving him out of the rotation after he had a good year, and then he came back once they finally let him start again and he looked really good. So this is really the early part of this season was the first stretch in recent memory where he was starting and he wasn't being very successful at it, regardless of the fact that he didn't, he wasn't sexy periphery guy. He was still a guy that you thought, wow, this guy is underrated. He's on the best team in baseball, conceivably, and he's going to get great run support. They actually play decent defense behind him, etc. and so forth. But it hasn't really worked out that way this year. So as an ultimate, I think you're going to see, because of the fact that he wasn't sexy to begin with and his numbers aren't going to look great this year, I see sort of a buying potential next year for a potential bounce back. So I'm glad that he's showing some of this, some of his skills are more on display statistically in recent starts. And I think he's a very late bargain next year in drafts. I really do.
Matt, are you interested in Tanner Roark?
A little bit. I mean, I kind of have to be. He grew up about 30 miles from where, about 20 miles from where I live. I think I actually played baseball against him a few times when he was in the youth leagues with me. But I like Roark a little bit in the sense that he's going to provide. I think this year is his floor. What you're looking at is his floor this year, and he's been snake bitten a little bit by the home run ball, which is not an uncommon theme across baseball this year for any pitcher, really. So I question, you always got to be curious. Justin's brought this up a few times on this podcast. Major League Baseball is investigating the baseballs. So by them even investigating it, you would think they're going to change something. And if they go back to, revert to an older, not as lively, I guess, for lack of a better word, baseball, you could see him maybe regaining some of that success. But then again, so will every other pitcher in baseball too. So his value should stay kind of constant. But you have to draft Tanner Roark looking for safety in the whip category, which is an under-talked about stat in fantasy because it is a fantasy stat that really you don't hear much. You hear about the strikeout guys and you can see the big shiny ERA guys and the FIP and XFIP, to back that up. But whip is a fantasy stat that no one really talks about. And Roark, normally this year the walks have gone up, but he's normally going to be pretty safe in the walks department. So you can kind of do a good job of pairing Tanner Roark with maybe an Andrew Miller type, and you can get your 9 Ks per 9 on average. And then with Tanner Roark to keep the peripherals down. But I like Roark. I'm surprised the numbers aren't a little bit better being on the Nationals this year, but the bullpen's probably cost him a few wins on that aspect. So he's a guy I definitely would look to grab late next year.
Yeah, I think I'm probably going to be out on him next year. I got a little burnt by him this year. I felt like, to steal another Matthew Berry term, the hate had gone a little bit too far on Tanner Roark. People were projecting him to have some obvious regression, and I think that was fair. Obviously, it was fair, but I think people were maybe overblowing it a little bit too much, though if you look at the numbers, maybe they weren't. And so I thought I was getting a discounted rate this year, grabbed him in a number of leagues, and unfortunately it has not worked out very well so far. And he just doesn't strike out enough guys for what the floor is. So I think if he was a guy who was striking out 9-10 per 9 and had this kind of bad ERA and ratio floor, then he's a guy that maybe, yeah, I'm willing to take a shot. Maybe he, gets a little bit lucky. Maybe things kind of go his way. I mean, his strand rate is abysmal this year. Maybe that comes back to earth. Maybe some other things, kind of even out for him. And you're getting a guy who's got a league average ERA, but, with good strikeouts. Without the nice strikeouts, it becomes harder to take a gamble on a guy like Tanner Roark. So for that reason alone, I'm out on him for next year. Let's talk about Kevin Kiermaier before we wrap up. Kiermaier is another guy who has missed a lot of this season due to injury. He's only played in 73 games. But the numbers actually look pretty decent in those 73 games. 10 home runs, 11 stolen bases, a .272, .341, .448 triple slash. Todd, what are your thoughts on Kevin Kiermaier rest of the way and then looking into next year?
Yeah, I liked him a lot this year. And, there's no, other than the injury, there's no reason not to. It's kind of the same as Crawford. He's going to be in the lineup because of the glove. So, I mean, the injury is going to discount the numbers enough that I'm going to look for him next year, just as I did this year. A guy to get me not a ton of steals, but help me in the steals category without completely destroying my power. So I'm, NFBC, he's a fourth or fifth outfielder for me.
Chuck, what are your thoughts on Kiermaier?
I'm okay with him in that role. I do note that he's gotten a little bit lucky with his BABIP this year, which, I don't really want to overstate. I agree with all the other points about him. I don't like the part of his profile I don't like is the 24% K rate for the kind of hitter that he is. And I also am not a fan. I usually don't invest in the Rays offense. which is going to maybe sound a little bit silly this year because obviously Souza, you know, really came around this year, and maybe they're showing some signs of life that they didn't before. But traditionally, the Rays are a team that I don't really trust offensively. They don't invest in their offense, if at all, because of their meager payroll. They seem to be a good pitching team that traditionally lacks offense. And maybe I'm holding that against him more than I should. It's also comical, the penny pinching. I know we're not a current events show by any means, but that Brent Honeywell has pitched so well, and they refuse to call him up no matter what he does. I've often said that if I was a prospect, the last team I would want to play for is the Rays, because they will penny pinch first and foremost before a player's development, and they've done it for years. And so it's just a sign of it's not a good team. It's not sound strategy year in and year out to invest in Tampa Bay bats, in my opinion.
Matt, what are your thoughts on Kiermaier?
Kiermaier, he's an interesting case for me. He's a guy I'm probably not going to end up a lot of shares with next year. Like Chuck said, I think the BABIP's a little bit high, but again, he's a speed guy. I mean, it's pretty remarkable. In 73 games, you're looking at a guy with double-digit homers and steals. So I think that shows you, he's like for DFS kind of type of player. He gives you a considerable output for that. But I think he lacks that ever elusive sixth fantasy tool for me, and health. Health is that tool. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be a thing that's got him 3 out of 4, especially the last 2 years. He plays with a reckless abandon, kind of like we talked about with Bryce Harper and guys like Kevin Pillar and stuff. And he's always one dive away from a shoulder, tearing up a shoulder and not being the same player ever again. And a guy with this little thin margin of error for power anyways, you know what I mean? He's not a big power threat. I do think he could probably scrape by with I wouldn't be surprised if he hits 20 home runs next year if he can stay healthy. But that's not – I mean, there's something like 200 players this year that are going to hit 20 home runs. So you look at a guy like that who's one shoulder injury away from losing his 20-homer potential and drops down to about 13 to 14. I mean, how valuable is he in the fantasy game then? And I know steals are his number one thing. And again, you know, legs, first thing to get – most common thing to get injured on a position player are his legs, hips, or something, you know, lower body. So again, you're baiting into there with a high-risk injury guy, and, you know, he's built up on that game. Ultimately, I do think this is probably the player he is. I think a little bit of BABIP help, but he's probably a 260 hitter on regular outcome, 260-320 guy, which is nothing to sneeze at, but I don't think it's very relevant unless you're playing in 15-plus team leagues. And if I end up with Kiermaier a lot next year, it's going to be because a lot of things in my draft went wrong, and he's kind of my backup plan.
I think what you mentioned in terms of his health is definitely got to weigh him down a little bit. I mean, this is the second season in a row where he hasn't broken, you know, 450 plate appearances because of injuries. And I think that obviously lowers his value, but I think he is a guy that is going, like Todd mentioned, very much like Brandon Crawford, is going to play every day while he is healthy, is going to accumulate stats for you. And he accumulates a very very useful stat in stolen bases. I mean, he's a guy that in about 400 plate appearances last year stole 20 bases. So, I mean, you could say if he can figure out how to stay healthy, I mean, he's a guy that could potentially be like a 15-25, 15-30 guy if things broke right for him. So, for that reason, and because I think he will come at a huge discount, guys who kind of come back from injury and perform well at this point in the season sometimes get overlooked as people start looking on to football. And so he's a guy that I think will be a little bit underdrafted coming in next year. And so I will take advantage, especially because I think 20 stolen bases at any position has pretty decent value in this day and age.
Can I, if you don't mind me interjecting quick, I was wondering, I want to be corrected, and I got the right panel of experts to do it, but is the last major offensive free agent that the Rays signed Pat Burrell? Is that correct?
It'll probably be Logan Morrison this offseason.
Yeah, Logan Morrison was pretty impactful.
But I think Pat Burrell was the last one they actually invested in that was supposed to help the offense dramatically. And it doesn't, in a way, it doesn't matter for his individual statistics, but it also caps his upside if the team is likely to return to its past ineptitude offensively.
I just think, I think besides Evan Longoria, I mean, he's probably the safest Ray to maintain his starting role next year because the defense is going to keep him on the field when he's healthy.
So I don't think there's much to worry about as far as Kiermaier in that aspect.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't think the lot, I mean, outside of, you know, Lucas Duda being a free agent and Logan Morrison being a free agent, I don't think that lineup changes a whole bunch. You know, and they could be bringing up some of their top prospects at some point next year, because at some point they have to bring up their prospects. So I actually think the lineup could be just fine, because it shouldn't change around too much next season.
No.
All right. That's going to wrap us up for this episode. Todd, thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you guys.
Why don't you, again, remind people where you can reach on social media, and then or where you can ignore them on social media, and then also plug all your work.
Yeah, follow me at Todd Zola. Like I said, I don't generally answer questions like some of the other guys, just because I need more than 140 letters. But I will, if you're smart, if you really want my answer, you know where to, you can track it down. And then I work at RotoWire, do some stuff for ESPN, Masters Ball Forum. And if you, you actually want to see just how sloppy my body actually is, I'll be out in November at the First Pitch Forum with Baseball HQ. I'll be a speaker there. And there, you know what? I will answer your question.
Matt, what are you working on? Where can you be reached on social media?
I just dropped a piece off the site, doing farm system rankings, a little bit from the fantasy perspective. So it's kind of interesting to look at, you know, where teams rank as far as fantasy, because it doesn't really, the depth of a system doesn't matter nearly as much in that realm. So it's fun to see the impact players coming up through the system. The second segment of that should be up shortly. But other than that, just you know, watching the Cardinals lose games and watching, you know, baseball as much as I can, and trying to prep for this football draft I have tomorrow, which is, I guess I'll be asking you a lot of questions, Justin, so hopefully you're available tomorrow night.
Well, I believe you and I are supposed to on the radio tomorrow night, so hopefully you can manage both things. So, Chuck, what are you working on? Where can people reach you?
Well, of course, I can be reached at Just Chucking It on Twitter, and I don't know if I should be proud for myself or negative. First of all, I think I love being able to talk with the guests that we had this week, and I think it's a special privilege for the listeners to have this much brain power on. But I don't know if I should be proud of myself or mad at myself, because Darius isn't here. So when I mentioned that the 28th team in Matt's rankings is the Giants, so it doesn't have as much impact. I mean, I'm only really digging in at Justin. I'm not really digging in at Justin and Darius like I would like to be. But I did take the high road, and until the very end of the show, I never mentioned that Danny Duffy and Tony La Russa have a similarity in life now. So, I mean, at least I didn't do that, because which is important to me, because I love Matt Thompson's work, and I love actually
Tony La Russa, considered like a friend King? Of his.
No, he just, it's the same driving habits. Let's put it that way.
Oh, yeah. No, that's no good. Never do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I actually wrote a little bit of blurb on the whole Danny Duffy situation in my my column on FanGraphs this morning, and my Roto write-up column. I surprised no one backlashed at it. I'm sure it will come up on the radio show tomorrow, which you can hear on the Fantasy Sports Radio Network, and you can hear a couple of these voices on there. Todd has a regular segment towards the end of the show. Matt's going to be joining us in talking about potential September call-up guys. And then Scott Bogman of the In This League podcast is going to fill in for Lore tomorrow. So that should be fun. So definitely check that out. You can read all my baseball stuff on FanGraphs, where I write 4 to 5 times a week. You can read other stuff of mine on friendsoffantasybenefits.com. And special announcement, I've been kind of teasing this for a while, waiting for it to be official, but I'm officially now a staff writer over at Fantasy Alarm. So Fantasy Alarm has picked me up for the football season. So if you are prepping for football or need help prepping for your week-to-week matchups and things like that, I'll be doing a really, really, really large article profiling every single fantasy-relevant player in every single game that I believe comes out on Wednesday night or Thursday. So it's looking like, as I start to prep the first one, it's going to be like a 10,000-word article every week. So that should be fun to write, but I'm grateful and excited for that opportunity over at Fantasy Alarm. So definitely check that out. Follow me on Twitter at JustinMasonFWFB. All right, that is going to wrap us up for this episode. For Chuck, Matt, Todd, and myself, thank you for listening. Have a fantastic baseball season.